You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey, y'all. Spooky season is here. And if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley, not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, and St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
Monster House presents.
Monster Talk is supported by listeners like you. Find out how you can contribute via Patreon or with reviews at monstertalk.org/support. Your contributions, large or small, make a huge difference. Thanks.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
When you think of fictional towns and stories and novels, I'm sure many come to mind. Lovecraft had Arkham and Dunwich. Stephen King invented Derry and Castle Rock. Faulkner had a whole Mississippi County in his Yuknapatawpha tales. And Charles Dickens had Mudfog. I'd never heard of the place, but in preparing for this interview, I did a brief visit, and I will be going back for a more thorough tour because it's quite a peculiar town, and we'll hear more about that in our show. If you only know Dickens' ghostly writing from A Christmas Carol, you might be surprised that the man who gave us Oliver Twist and Great Expectations also wrote many a spooky story and inspired some of the greatest ghost story writers in English lit. The Signalman is such a tale. It's sort of a ghost story, but perhaps it's something else. Regardless, it's a tale of mystery with intriguing details that seem to be tied to some experience from Dickens' own life. The story was published in 1866, and a year before that, Dickens was on a train that had a terrible crash which killed several and injured many. The experience was said to have rattled him for the last years of his life, and I needn't go into details on why. Your imagination's surely up to the task. But you may hear more about The Signalman before this year is out. But here we are in this weird gap between Halloween and Christmas, two holidays indelibly connected with ghost tales, and perhaps no single person did more to connect Christmas with ghosts than Charles Dickens with his A Christmas Carol. It's hard to believe, but much of what we think of as modern Christmas was invented in the past century and a half, and Dickens' work cemented a lot of that imagery in the mind of English readers around the world. But there's plenty more ghosts and weirdness in his work, and if you check the show notes, you'll find links to lots of free reading.
Monster Talk.
Today we're talking with Dr. Liz Savage, an academic whose work is focused on Charles Dickens, but also the uncanny, the unusual, and harder to categorize things like steampunk. And we're going to be discussing the ways that Charles Dickens' work overlaps with the paranormal, the ghostly, the weird, and she'll also argue that one can view his work with a cryptozoological lens. Liz works with the Cambridge University Library and will be participating in the International Institute of English Studies Dickens Day event on November 26th, 2022. Welcome to Monster Talk.
Thank you.
Today, we're going to talk about Charles Dickens, and it's fun because I'm a longtime fan of certain works of Dickens, but I'm, you know, he's written a lot more than I've read. Yeah, yeah.
I think there is always that
weird thing where it's taught so much in high school and whatnot that it turns a lot of people off.
Like Shakespeare.
Yeah, I think it becomes, you know, it might, you read the wrong text and then you just never want to pick up Dickens again.
Sure.
But it, I mean, I had a different experience, so.
Well, I know everybody knows A Christmas Carol, which has ghosts, but I also love the ghost story, The Signalman, and the sort of backstory to that one, which we may get into. But I guess my question to start out with is, how often does weird or quasi-paranormal stuff show up in Dickens' work? Because it's certainly more than I expected.
Oh, it's one of those things that sometimes tends to be skipped over, or maybe not skipped over, but certainly not focused on in earlier Dickens studies, like when you're in high school or even undergrad. So it comes up a lot and more than you think. I mean, right up into Edwin Drood, you're having that kind of eerie ghost vibe, but also just the descriptions of various characters can get into that uncanny realm, which is kind of what my research focuses on. If we're talking just ghosts, I mean, you've got various Christmas stories that he wrote, but then you also have weird things like spontaneous combustion, some really good thriller moments, especially my favorite is Bleak House, so I apologize if I somehow make everything about Bleak House, but you get these really great, just almost sci-fi descriptions of characters that you wouldn't really expect, and kind of surprise you, I think, if you're not reading Dickens, you know, regularly. It's kind of like, oh, I didn't know he wrote like that. And like just the other day, I was looking through Bleak House and I was reading the end of a important chapter to save spoilers from a 1850s novel. And it was so well written. It's so instrumental to the novel, and it was just so creepy when I read it. And I just you almost forget, I think, because you there is that reputation that Dickens holds as the Victorian sort of, I don't want to say gentleman, but kind of, you know, you don't expect it out of a Victorian classic, I guess.
Sure. Yeah, and you answered our next question, which was about Dickens and whether he covered spontaneous human combustion or not. That was in Bleak House too, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. It happens about midway through the novel, I think. It happens to a character named Crooks, I believe. And yes, it's spontaneous human combustion.
A quick insert about spontaneous human combustion. This is a topic which I assume many listeners will be familiar with, but which we've never covered on the show. There have been many peculiar fire-related deaths where people find bodies that are almost entirely consumed by fire, but where perhaps a foot or an arm will remain unburned, and the surrounding room will be largely unharmed, as though the person just went up in a puff of flame and smoke. The literature on this is creepy, and I certainly grew up with an unwarranted fear of succumbing to just such a demise. Like any phenomena, the items that fit within the category often have a variety of causes, but the majority of the cases usually involve enough elements that we can exclude supernatural. Classically, in order to have a fire, you need three legs of the fire triangle: heat, oxygen, and fuel. What has been surmised by forensic fire researchers who look into cases like this is that often people who die in alleged spontaneous human combustion cases are in some way incapacitated by a fall where they strike their heads, or by alcohol or perhaps drugs. A heat source is usually present, such as a lit cigarette or a fireplace, and usually the victims have plenty of body fat. And when you combine these elements, you have everything to explain at least a big chunk of these SHC cases. There's a scientifically reproducible scenario that relies on something called the wick effect. If a heat source is applied to fat and skin and clothing, a fire can get going, which will render the human body fat into a slow-burning fuel, and the corpse will literally just disappear into soot and charred fat like a giant human candle. Evidence suggests that the often unconscious victims will die of smoke inhalation if they haven't already stopped breathing for some other reason. If nothing interrupts the process, it just keeps going until the fuel runs out and you end up with this weird and disturbing crime scene imagery that makes this the hallmark of most books on weird phenomena. I'll put a link in the show notes to a couple of articles by Joe Nickel and John Fisher that examine this creepy but largely scientifically explained occurrence.
Do we have any idea of why he wrote about this? Was he just fascinated with this topic, or had he had some kind of personal experience with that those claims?
He does have the typing you hear is me looking up, because there is a note that Dickens includes about spontaneous human combustion at the start of, I think, the serial, when it was serially published. There is, if you, what you hear in the background is my dog barking because it's bonfire night here. And so there's fireworks going off and my dog is kind of losing his mind.
Sure, sure. My daughter came running downstairs to tell me this morning, today's the day. Today's the day that Marty McFly goes back to in 1955 in Back to the Future. And I was like, really? And how do you remember today? And she was like, this is some kind of a joke, isn't it? It totally is. So I had to explain to her Guy Fawkes and the gunpowder plot and all that stuff. Fun. Much fun was had.
I completely forgotten about it. And then my husband said, oh, you better go get the Thunder shirt. And I was like, what are you talking about? And it's what we put on the dog to make him calm down. And he's like, it's bonfire night. And I was like, oh, no. So what he did was, this happened, you know, he got a bit of backlash from it. And so as it was being published serially, he was able to kind of put in a response. And he pretty much said, there are mysteries we can't account for. So I think it is definitely one of those things in the 19th century, Bleak House being 1850s, you're kind of on this precipice of change, something that I think we can really relate to now, where technology is advancing so much. Our understanding of science and how things, you know, just work. I mean, if you look at it from the year 1800, say, in Jane Austen-y kind of, I guess, Bridgerton, if you will, type setting to the late 1800s, 1900s, it's a completely different world. And so I think what we do see in Dickens that lends itself to the spontaneous combustion thing is this kind of curiosity, or this kind of latching on to new ideas, but also questioning older ones. But it is that kind of period. I focused a lot on technology in my earlier research, and it just reminded me so much of what we are experiencing today of just rapid progress. I mean, in the 19th century, you just had cities sprouting up. You had trains, you had factories, machinery, all of this stuff that was just invading life and changing it completely. And I feel like we're kind of experiencing that now with computers and the evolution of the iPhone, pretty much, is just, it's shocking how quickly it happens. You know, Dickens kind of playing into that uncertainty and also just having a bit of fun, because he was like that.
In preparing for this episode, I did not get to go read back through a lot of the Dickens story, which would have been probably better preparation, but I did a lot of meta reading. And one of the things I came across was the assertion that Dickens was influenced strongly by Washington Irving, but then Dickens' work went on to influence Edgar Allan Poe.
Yes.
Who in turn went back to influence people like M.R. James.
Yeah.
And some of the Victorian ghosts. So it's like there seems to be a really interesting transatlantic literary information swap. And it's happening simultaneous with the rise of spiritualism as a religious movement, which had a sort of separate evolution in England than it did in America. But I guess I'm wondering, does Dickens' turn towards the supernatural correspond with the rise of spiritualism, or is that just coincidental, or is it related, or
Well, spiritualism, what we think of spiritualism, I'm pretty sure, if I've got my history correct, started mostly with the Fox sisters.
Right, which I think was 1840s, yes. I think.
Yeah, so there is a bit of that, and I think there's certainly, you know, those early kind of rumblings of spiritualism in the Victorian period, especially when you get to the 1870s and you have Darwin and everything. I think that is, you know, just such a monumental moment of what is a human, what are we, where do we fall in this, you know, in the universe, and that kind of sets, you know, religion kind of on a tailspin, and, you know, how we digest who we are. So I think there's definitely a feeling of exchange in Dickens. We see one of the things that I focused on in my PhD thesis was the what felt to me like a spectrum of characters that where his protagonist kind of started out in his early work as very mechanical, very robotic almost, especially in the language he used. Nell in The Old Curiosity Shop is referred to as a waxwork child. But as we get into his later novels, that kind of switches, and suddenly it's the protagonists are more animalistic, and you have Eugene Rayburn in Our Mutual Friend saying, you know, comparing himself to a sheep, saying, you know, man as I am, mutton as you are, and quote unquote villain of the story is far more mechanical. And I think that kind of shows how his concept of the human is changing, I guess. Like, rather than being like nuts and bolts, suddenly we're becoming this more nebulous thing. Maybe we're more related to the animals around us than, you know, we previously thought. I'm putting words in Dickens' mouth there. but I do think there is that very interesting shift. Mm-hmm. And I think I wouldn't put it past it to be because of such a shift in perceptions of religion. And I mean, he was also friends with people like Wilkie Collins, who was living a completely bohemian lifestyle. And I think, you know, Dickens was rather trapped in, you know, the Victorian setting, in that he marketed himself a certain way and he couldn't really change that.
That was all very interesting. But I want to ask you about this cryptid. Dickens cryptid. So what is this cryptid, and in which tale?
It's not something super specific. Kind of stems out of Mudfog, which is a very early Dickens writing. It was written alongside Oliver Twist in Bentley's Miscellany. Originally, Oliver Twist was part of Mudfog, and then Dickens later edited. Yeah, the first line of Oliver Twist was changed from its serialized version to its printed version, or its like compiled version. Oliver was originally from Mudfog, but that was changed to read a town of not worth mentioning or something. Okay. Tell me how you really feel. But it stems out of that, because the Mudfog papers, the first one's just a story about a mayor. The second and third one are parodies of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, which was quite a new thing, and they would publish very, you know, earnest, you know, reports about various different discoveries. And so this kind of lends on to the science and spiritualism side of things. But so he wrote these two parody reports from the Mudfog Association for the Advancement of Everything. I have said that so many times, I don't trip over it anymore. And it's written in the style of reports, but with just ridiculous things like a train that is like part of a pocket watch that you would put onto your shoes and it would take you different places. And if you wanted to if several people want to go to one place, they could join arms and just be led through the sewers. The one I focused on mostly was the Automaton City that he created, that actually has an illustration for it by George Cruikshank, where you get can see Dickensian robots. And it was kind of like a crazy moment when I saw that.
Wow, this is more steampunk than I expected.
Yeah,
he did everything.
And so it's this city of robots, pretty much built for the entertainment of young gentlemen. And they pretty much, it's just a free-for-all. They can beat up people, and the robots will respond and shrieks, and you know, they can dismantle them.
It's Westworld.
Pretty much, yeah, it is. It's Westworld.
Wow.
So really my focusing on like the uncanny and the weird and really stemmed from Mudfog. And recently I decided to, you know, kind of bend that into cryptozoology. Because it's funny, because I was literally just came up on Twitter. I was just having a conversation with a few other academics, and they were talking about, oh, do you think you could say that Dickens has moments where there's like, or you could fit a UFO reading into Dickens? And I was like, well, there's this part in Mudfog where a pug dog gets dissected, and I bet you could do it like an alien abduction reading of it. Because he does do this really weird thing where right after the pug dog is dissected, it suddenly the owner comes, you know, running in, and they said, oh, well, the pug dog was supposed to be in place of like her lost lover or something, and that it bore a striking resemblance to him. And I was like, oh, I wonder if you could read that, in a UFO abduction way. And that kind of got me on the whole monster thing.
That is that's such a weird quit. The only thing I read in Mudfog to prepare for this episode was the section on that dog. So I know exactly the section you're talking about. Yes. And it freaked me out because I had just read Zelazny's A Night in Lonesome October, which has a whole section where one of the main characters is a dog who gets captured by vivisectionists in the 1880s. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, what are the odds of vivisection coming up twice in like a month of reading, like randomly, just reading random things? And it's like,
oh, that is weird.
That is very odd. It's very odd. I don't know how common vivisection was in English lit back then, but it had a big. And by the way, for listeners, if you don't know vivisection, this was a sort of scientific movement where people were studying animals while doing surgery on them while they had no anesthetic. Let me just say it that way. And it led directly to things like the Island of Dr. Moreau, which in some sense was sort of it was a screed against vivisection and therefore anti-vivisectionist literature, I guess, in a sense.
And Dickens was against vivisection.
But it's really funny. It's a very funny story. Like, I mean, it doesn't seem like something that would be funny.
Yeah.
But the way it's written is sort of clinical detachment. And then it's like, we did this with the legs, we did this with the ears. Oh no, the owner showed up.
And oops, the dog reminds her of her ex-lover. Oh crud.
Oh boy.
Yeah. And not only do they vivisect the dog, but they use kitchen implements. They say they have a knives and forks and cutting board, and that's how they go about it. Oh. And there's a whole thing about trying to get the dog to sniff, I think it's prussic acid or something, to put it to sleep.
You know, it reminds me of Lewis and Clark. They were traveling through North America, and their diaries are quite dramatic. And they keep talking about running into grizzly bears. And at one point they're like, I believe we've had enough of grizzly bears. It's such a polite way to say it. Like, it's terror. It's a nightmare. Every time they run into a grizzly bear, something horrible happens. And they're like, I believe we've had enough of those.
There are actually bears in Mudfog as well. Dancing bears. I believe they are begging on curbsides because they're talking about this problem of out of work dancing bears, and it ties into bear oil, I believe, that was used for something. But there were bears and pickpocketing dogs. Dogs that pickpocket.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about. The stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose, it kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever, crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
We've got a podcast recommendation I think will be really fun and or useful for Monster Talk listeners. I Know Dino, the big dinosaur podcast.
Studying dinosaurs can teach us about the prehistoric world, but also the world of today. For example, migration patterns of dinosaur lineages can tell us about the Earth's changing continents.
Climate models of dinosaur ecosystems help us understand global warming.
Studying dinosaur diets can help show the link between plant and animal evolution.
Talk about paleo. In many dinosaur injuries, paleopathologies are the first known occurrences of diseases.
A new episode of I Know Dino comes out every week with new dinosaur discoveries you won't hear about anywhere else. You can find I Know Dino on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As I said, he's written about everything. It was ahead of his time.
Yeah, very much. Also very much a product of it. Again, just to bring up that moment last week when I was just reading that excerpt from Bleak House, it's just like, man, this is why I studied him. Because it's just
so much to unpack.
Exactly, yeah.
Leaning back to that, again, we know from what you've said that Dickens was open-minded about spontaneous human combustion, given the time and the knowledge that people had at the time. But do we know much about whether he was more of a skeptic or a believer? He certainly wrote about a lot of these kinds of paranormal stories like ghosts in A Christmas Carol. But do we know much about where he stood on those topics?
In terms of religion, I think he was quite hard to pin down specifically. He was, you know, I think he was just generally religious and had the, you know, general Victorian beliefs. Nothing I can recall really sticks out. I'm trying to, and I'm sure there are like Dickens scholars just shouting at me right now. But I have to be like, no, I study very early Dickens. And here I go bringing up Bleak House. But it's a great example, I think, of where he stood with religion. He wasn't, there's these two characters. One is, you know, does letter writing campaign sort of thing to raise awareness for starving kids in Africa, something to that extent. And then there's another one that evangelizes so much that she goes into the house of this abusive couple and she just forces spirituality on them. And the guy is like, are you serious? Like the husband is really like, are you serious right now? So he was seemed to be really against that sort of blatant evangelism. He doesn't really make many firm religious statements. So I think when it, and I keep bringing up spiritualism and religion and stuff like that, because I think in the Victorian period, they're still quite intertwined. And I think where he falls in terms of believing in things like ghosts and spontaneous combustion probably has its roots in where he kind of sat religiously. And since he's kind of, you know, just generically religious, I guess. And this is just me postulating. But he was also incredibly theatrical. Oh, wow. I think if he wasn't an author, he would have been an actor, and probably a good one. And I think that kind of opens you up to a lot more fantastical things. And so I would postulate that he would probably be more open to things because of his theatrical nature, or he'd be open to including them because of his theatrical nature. But again, I think because it is kind of difficult to state, you know, where he was on a religious side, and therefore that, and that's kind of, as I said, tied up with, you know, what you would believe. I think those kind of moments are more, you know, fantastical in a sense that he just, you know, he was so theatrical. He loved the stage. Mm-hmm. I mean, he did readings of his own works until, you know, he practically gave out from exhaustion. And he would do all the voices, and he was so into it. I think it comes down to theatricality and, you know, how exciting maybe it was.
That makes sense.
He didn't live long enough to have his voice recorded, though, right?
No, sadly. He died in 1871.
Oh, he got close.
He got close. He did. We have plenty of pictures of him, no recordings. But yeah, he did get close. And one of the interesting things is that he was so close to cinema as well, which would have been, you know, insane to see.
You would have loved it.
Yeah, because I mean, just a lot of early films were of Dickens' texts, because he has that pathos and that melodrama, and it's so easy to translate into film. And so Dickens is very much a precursor to a lot of cinema, which is just interesting as well. I'm complete tangent.
No, but things like some of the earliest cinema was supernatural stuff too. So
yeah,
When I was growing up, I remember reading, this does not shock anybody, monster books, and one of the things they would always show is still images from Edison's lost movie of Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
In my lifetime, they have found that footage, and now it's restored, and I can show my kids the silent movie Edison's Frankenstein. It's so peculiar and disgusting and cool, and it's like, it's hard to, I can't even imagine what audiences must have thought of it, but it's fascinating to me.
I think cinema is, you know, kind of my second love to literature, and I especially love older horror movies like that, just because the black and white silence just lends itself so well to that sort of storytelling.
Well, I mean, like Nosferatu, I think it still holds up incredibly well.
Mm-hmm.
Metropolis, the silent film Wings. I can think of like lots of other ones.
Cabinet.
But I did want to clarify something. I feel like when we talked about cryptids, I may have lost the answer. What is the actual cryptid in Mudfog?
Yeah, sorry. My husband said, when you go on there, do not go on tangents. You always go on tangents.
Oh, we all go. That's how our show is literally Tangent, the series. So it's okay.
I just have a habit of turning into Tristram Shandy, where I go to tell, you know, my birth story, and I don't get to it till chapter 5.
No worries.
So, let me tell you about my conception, okay?
Yeah, I mean, that's if you're familiar with Tristram Shandy, great book. So the cryptid, it's more of the idea of cryptozoology itself. I think in today's, you know, approach to cryptozoology and whatnot, we're using terms that we're already familiar with to describe something that is unfamiliar to us. That's something that I really want to focus on in the paper I'm giving, is this, is the uncanniness of cryptids, that there is something that we recognize, whether it be an animal or a human, or, you know, a machine even, but we don't have the words and we don't have the science or, you know, to properly state what we're seeing, because we just don't know. It's kind of like how we don't understand, how we don't know most of the ocean. We don't have the words, we don't have the research into it. We don't know. So that's built on it. But I didn't want to just, you know, kind of go off and be all philosophical about it. So I did kind of take some characters and I said, what if these were cryptids? The first one, well, the first two being Oliver Twist, who is from Mudfog, and Nell from the old Curiosity Shop, and kind of compared them to Black Eyed Kids. They're these creepy, like very perfect children, especially Oliver, who is born in a, is born poor, is in a workhouse, you know, but yet when he talks in perfect English. And it's very, very odd. And I whether or not you'd see it during the Victorian period as odd, I'm not sure. But for, you know, for a current reader, I think it's quite interesting to, you know, look at Dickens in kind of that lens of creepy black-eyed kid, you know, kind of just an empty vessel. And almost, I don't want to say robotic, but... very close to that idea that your birth is assigns you, you know, your status. So because Oliver was technically of higher birth, he had a, you know, more elevated sense of speaking. But I kind of wanted to take that, turn it on its head a bit and say, yeah, I think he's a black-eyed kid. And then there's Nell, who will walk through the snow barefoot and doesn't die till the end of the novel. I just find her creepy. And she, not only that, but she has those these moments where she's like among waxworks and she's described as a waxwork child. And it's just, they're just quite creepy. They're like, they're too perfect and you wouldn't let them in if they knocked on your door. And I can see why Mr. Bumble didn't want to give Oliver more food. Because, you know, having that kind of creepy child ask for more, I'd kind of be like, no.
Well, now you've got me imagining Fagin with a passel of automatons.
Yeah. I mean, comparatively, like the Artful Dodger is far more human than Oliver. He's got, you know, a way about his words, and, you know, whereas Oliver is just like, you know, this very well-spoken, shouldn't be like that. He's very out of place. And then there's Quilp, who is the antagonist in the old Curiosity Shop, and I was kind of going back and forth whether or not I kind of think he's like the missing link, kind of like Bigfoot, but not quite Bigfoot, because he's described as just a complete animal, it's kind of in that way where they can't quite pin down what kind of animal, though. He's like compared to a dog, but then he's also like, I'm looking at the description now, it's just so it says, what added most to the grotesque expression of his face was a ghastly smile, which constantly revealed the few discolored fangs that were yet scattered in his mouth, and gave him the aspect of a panting dog. His dress consisted of a large high-crowned hat and worn dark suit, a pair of capacious shoes, and a dirty white neckerchief sufficiently limp and crumpled to disclose the greater portion of his wiry throat. His hands, which were of rough, coarse grain, were very dirty. His fingernails were crooked, long, and yellow. I mean, wow. if that's not an animal.
Beastly, yeah.
I just want to add, too, that if Dickens didn't blatantly write about cryptids and monsters, that he certainly wrote a lot about monstrous people and monstrous characters in his books.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think one of the texts I used for... my PhD was John Carey's Violent Effigy. He really goes into depth about Dickens's very animalistic, very violent characters. You also see it in like Little Dorrit's Rigaud, who was, just to give you an idea of what the character was like, he was played by Andy Serkis in one of the most recent adaptations. And Andy Serkis is like, you know, the character actor to go to. And that's kind of how that character was described, like a very animalistic, very much animal in a cage at the start of the novel. And he climbs buildings and
a complete circus performer. Got it.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I think I wanted to focus on, you know, those sorts of monstrous characters in cryptozoology, but also, you know, focus on the overall just concept of, you know, why do we study cryptozoology and why, how that kind of relates to, you know, anxieties that we have today and anxieties that mm-hmm. were present in the Victorian period.
I know one of the things like that people get caught up in the sort of the argument about literature as art versus literature as business. And Dickens uniquely, I think, for that period, seemed to really do both. He was clearly writing literature, but he was also doing it for the people and spreading it in innovative ways. Can you talk briefly about how Dickens promoted himself?
Yeah.
Because I know we kind of run low on time, but I want to make sure we cover that. He's quite modern.
I like to think of Dickens as his own PR machine, before PR machines, because he pretty much was like, okay, this is what I'm doing. And and this is who I am, and I cannot waver from that in a way. So obviously we know about how he wrote, you know, serialized novels. And I think the mythos today is more of this successful, constantly successful author, whereas that's not quite true. He had duds. He had times of, you know, economic anxiety because, you know, Barnaby Rudge didn't do well. You know, and they didn't perform, and he had arguments with, you know, other printers, and, you know, he had a whole copyright thing because his novels were being pirated, you know, into the States. You know, there were a lot of, you know, copies and whatnot because copyright wasn't a thing. But he was very much an early proponent of that, of, you know, taking ownership over his work. And of course, the serialized novel was a huge sign of an evolving readership, because the education was becoming more prevalent among all the classes. So he had more readers. So it was a huge reading public. It was bigger than ever before. And yeah, he promoted himself. I mean, when I talked about him doing readings, I mean, they were just as much a promotion of himself as it was, you know, fun for him to do. And people just ate it up. And, you know, it overshadows a lot of the nastiness in his life, how he was able to kind of, you know, emit this, you know, like Titan-like image that has lasted into today, which I think is, you know, pretty intense. I mean, good on him for that. A lot of people point to Oscar Wilde as being the first, you know, quote unquote celebrity. But I think Dickens was the quote-unquote first PR person. He knew how to work the news. He knew how to use it to his advantage. And I think, you know, even if he had duds, he was constantly churning out work. And, you know, I can't imagine what it would be like to know him, because he seems exhausting.
He was remarkable, but... We've just got one final question to wrap things up.
Yeah.
We always like to ask our guests, what's your favorite monster?
Oh, yes. See, it's like picking a favorite child for me, because I'm I'm such a horror fan. Okay, mulling it over in my head. Since we're doing Dickens, and this is about Dickens, I'll go with a Dickens character. And I will say The Ghost of Christmas Present from A Christmas Carol.
I am the Ghost of Christmas Present. Look upon me.
I have to admit, that was a suggestion from my husband, because, and I was like, I have to say, he was kind of right about it.
Remind listeners which one that is. Which ghost is? Yeah. What does this person look like?
Yeah. So the Ghost of Christmas Present is the jolly spirit, pretty much. If you've ever watched the Muppet Christmas Carol, like the, you know, the version of the Christmas Carol. He's the one that has the great song, like, you know, It Feels Like Christmas, and he's the, you know, he's very fun. But what's not in The Muppets Christmas Carol is how he actually ends his portion. And it's, he's standing in front of Scrooge and he opens his robe, and under his robe are two emaciated children.
This boy is ignorance. This girl is want. Beware them both.
And it's just like, it cuts off all that like merry feeling and just drives right back down into, you know, in, it's Dickens moralizing, which he does a lot of. But it's just so, I think
it's creepy.
It's creepy. And then
it's scary when you're a kid to see in the old movies.
Yeah. And then it, and then it leads into The Ghost of Christmas Past. So you're already kind of off kilter from this, and then it goes into The Ghost of Christmas Past. I think that makes a pretty good monster.
He interesting choice. In. We've never had that one before.
he moves you in with joy.
My brother-in-law is a huge fan of the Alistair Sim version of Christmas Carol, and I think the way it's presented there is
classic.
As you say, it's this incredibly, it's like a jolly Santa character who's also carrying around two starving children wrapped around his legs. It's so creepy. You're right.
Jarring.
Wow.
The nice one.
Well, I think you've whetted our appetite for more Dickens. So if you want to throw a few suggestions out, I'll put them in the show notes for some reading if people want to get a better view of Dickens beyond just A Christmas Carol. And I also link to an article about, there's a really fun article I read about seven ghost stories by Dickens that were not A Christmas Carol, and they're quite cool.
Haunted Man and Ghost Bargain. That's
fantastic. It's the idea of all this interplay between Irving and Dickens and Poe, which leads to the M.R. James type Christmas stuff that we know, or those ghost stories we think of as Edwardian and Victorian. I love this interplay. It's so cool. So thank you for sharing this.
It's a great time
with
of year for this.
Thank you for having me.
Monster Dog.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with Liz Savage about Charles Dickens and how his writing deals with the supernatural, the weird, the strange, and how it might even be viewed through the lens of the cryptozoological. She'll be participating in the International Institute of English Studies Dickens Day event on November 26, 2022. Monster Talk's a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Home of such shows as Fork in the Road, I Know What Scares You, and When Things Go Wrong. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com.
Karen Stolzno's new book, Fisher's Ghost and Other Stories, is out now, just in time for Halloween. From Monster Talk's co-host comes this anthology of supernatural short fiction. The characters within these pages include lovelorn ghosts, restless spirits, deceptive demons, and deeply flawed humans, their tales all told with a twist. These unsettling stories are guaranteed to give you nightmares. Fisher's Ghost and Other Stories is available for ebook and in paperback from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other online booksellers.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. We appreciate your listening and hope you learned something fun and useful today.
Been a Monster House presentation.
Anesthesia. They had no anesthetic. Let me just say it that way.